All right, so tonight we are not going to be doing a minor characters, unfortunately. I had trouble while looking for one. It was difficult. I actually had an idea to do one about the Geratoshav, but in the end, I just could not find enough that was at least of interest to me. So I didn't think that was going to be of interest to you. So we are doing the subject of ribbit, interest, taking interest. So the Torah says, after the whole section about Shmita and Yovel, it's actually a very strange pasuk in terms of the ending of the pasuk. It says, if your brother, your co-religionist, your friend should be in dire straits, right? Should be in trouble. And he comes to you, so you have to support him. Hachzaktabo. Then the end of the pasuk is a little bit strange. Ger v'toshav v'chayimach. So how are we supposed to understand this? So the way this translation does it is, you hold him as though a resident alien. In other words, you take care of him just like you would take care of a ger toshav. Now, like I said, I was thinking about talking about ger toshav, which is a very complicated sugya. Whether it's ger toshav, ger v'toshav, whether it's a ger tzedek, whether it's a regular ger, what he has to do in order to qualify as a ger. But either way, over here, apparently, you're supposed to take care of him the same, take care of your Jewish brother the same way that you would take care of a ger toshav, which just tells you that you're supposed to take care of a ger toshav, right? It's a kal vachomer, it works that way. Anyways, al tikach meito neshech v'tarbit v'yarta me'alohecha v'chei achicha imach. You shall not take from him neshech or tarbit. What's neshech and what's tarbit? So the English over
Nesach
here
is
is
usually
advance or
interest.
accrued interest. What was that?
Was going to say Nesach is usually translated as interest.
Yeah, and well, then what's tarbit? So that's where it gets complicated. Let's leave them untranslated for now. Let's leave them untranslated for now. And then the Torah said, here it gets a little bit clearer, perhaps, because it says, you shall not give your money as neshech, and your food shall not be given as marbit. Okay? This is basically, I didn't take you out in order for you to get involved in the business of usury. Now, actually, the Mishnah and Gemara and Bava Metzia addresses this question of what is neshech and what is tarbit. So the Mishnah says, which is the case in which there is neshech? With regard to one who lends another, actually, you know what? Before we do that, let's just ask a few questions. All right, anybody have any questions about this whole section? Anything bothering us about it?
Can you define a ger toshav?
For now, let's just say a ger toshav is a person who is not Jewish, but observes the Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach. Let's make it simple.
The
And
pasuk
lives amongst
refers to
them.
the pasuk refers to a ger vetoshav. Is
Yes,
the
so
toshav
it's
here
somewhat
a
of a yeah. So it's somewhat of a dispute. It could be that a ger is a ger tzedek and a toshav is the thing that I described, or it could be that it's ger v'toshav is one phrase. Somewhat of a dispute amongst the Rishonim about what exactly it means and how to read it. And Unklus weighs in over there. Anything else? What do we know? What do we know about interest? Should we wait until we get to? Yeah. What do we know about interest? What are you allowed to do? What are you not allowed to do?
You're not allowed to charge an exorbitant amount,
No, it's not that
but
good.
I don't know if you're allowed to charge a minimum amount, an amount that would be acceptable if you were doing plain business.
So you're not allowed to charge any amount of interest to a fellow Jew at all. No amount of interest. There's forms of interest that are d'oraita, there's forms of interest that are d'rabbanan, but let's just say it's an area that people don't know nearly enough about, myself included, because many of the things that we do could be considered interest, could be considered ribbit, at least d'rabbanan, and we're not even aware about them. Like, for example, there's a form of interest which is if you even thank somebody for something profusely. And that in principle could be, or in theory, I should say, in theory could be a form of interest. This is not to say that we shouldn't thank people. It's just to say that there is some form like that. But paying people back after they lend you money and adding on could be a violation of ribis. Even borrowing sugar, right? And then giving sugar back, let's say, in a few weeks' time could potentially be ribis because the price of sugar might have gone up. So you always have to be very careful. But to whom can you lend on interest?
No.
What's that?
To a non-Jew.
Sure. Mishpat Shylock, as Rav Zevin wrote. Rav Yosef Zevin, the author of Moedim BaHalacha. So he also wrote another sefer where he just has a bunch of essays on halacha, and in there he has one called Mishpat Shylock, where he examines the story of the Merchant of Venice of Shakespeare, and sees whether or not it accords with halacha or not. But basically, yeah, Jews throughout the ages have been, have loaned money on interest, have loaned money through usury. Why is that? Anybody know historically why that is, that Jews have gotten this reputation for being, for lending on interest?
Because they weren't allowed to engage in other commerce.
Because of all the mitzvahs, well, yeah, there's two parts to it. One part is what my father said, which is that Jews were banned for other forms of commerce. Everywhere we go, we start out at the bottom and we make our way up the economic ladder until people say that we've gotten too far. And then we get banned from all the jobs that we're good at and we have to do other things. So one of the things that we got very good at doing was lending on interest. But why are we lending on interest? Because as David was saying, I think that David was saying this, one of the only mitzvot that the church decided they were going to keep from the Hebrew Bible was the prohibition on interest, on ribis. So it's actually prohibited for a Christian to lend on interest to anybody. So irony of ironies, basically they left it to the Jews to lend on interest on their behalf. Okay, so that was a business that we got into because we weren't allowed into any other businesses and nobody was allowed into this business. Actually, it's interesting. Malcolm Gladwell records that investment bankers and mergers and acquisitions used to be and lawyers that try these kinds of big cases. It used to be a very unsavory job. Like people didn't want to do it, so the Jews did it because nobody else would do it. And now this is one of the best jobs in the world. And frankly, the Jews have somewhat cornered the market over there, to our detriment in some cases. So that's the way that it goes. So here's the question though. If the Torah doesn't like ribit for whatever reason, which we'll investigate, why is it okay with us lending on interest? And in fact, according to the Rambam, there may even be a mitzvah. There is a mitzvah to lend on interest to a non-Jew. When you lend money to a non-Jew, you're supposed to do it on interest. So if it's so bad, then why are we allowed to do it with non-Jews? That's question number one. Question number two, these mitzvot, as I said, come on the heels of Shemitah and Yovel. You have all these halachos of Shemitah and Yovel at the beginning of Bahar, and then all of a sudden it jumps into Ribit. The question is, what is it doing there? Question number three, and we touched upon this already, what is the difference between Neshech and Tarbit? Why do we have two words? So we'll start with that. We'll start with that last question. So the Mishnah actually in Bava Metzia says, what's the case of Neshech? And the answer it gives is that, here, as you can see, with regards to one who lends another a sela for 5 dinars to be paid, so something that was worth 4 dinars, and then says, I'm going to get paid back 5 dinars. So he charges him 25% interest, right? I think my math is good. Or if you lend 2 seah and want 3 seah in return, right? So this is just a classic case of charging interest when you lend money. That's a case of neshech. That's called neshech. What's a case of tarbit? So that's a case of one who enters into a transaction that yields an increase in the produce beyond his investment, meaning he acquires wheat from another person at the price of 1 kor, okay, of 1 kor for 1 gold dinar, and then, because that was the market price, and then that price increased, and then at that point the buyer says to the seller, give me all my wheat now as I wish to sell it and purchase wine with it. And the seller says to him, well, if it's wine that you want, not wheat, then I'll give it to you, but I'm going to do it by charging you interest. The seller did not have wine in his possession. If wine then appreciates in value, the result will be an interest-bearing transaction. In other words, he says, I'll give you the same thing in wine. I'll give you the same thing in wheat, but you give it to me in wine. And basically, he makes money on the deal. Okay, so according to the Mishnah, basically what it seems to be saying is that Netshach is with pure money and Tarbit is with produce. Okay? Is that somewhat clear to everybody? So the Gemara, right after this, which I've basically reduced to the conclusion, the Gemara goes back and forth trying to figure out, can we come up with a case of Neshech, which is not Tarbit, or a case which is Tarbit, but not Neshech? And what do you think the answer is? So the Gemara concludes and says, Rava says, you cannot find Neshech without Tarbit, or Tarbit without Neshech. Okay, so then why do we have two words in the Torah if they're basically indistinguishable? The verse distinguishes between them only so that lending with interest always involves violating two prohibitions. In other words, why does the Torah have Neshech and Tarbit? Trivia question, you can ask this at your tables. Is there a difference between Neshech and Tarbit? In concept, yes, but in practice, no. They're the exact same, they cover the exact same cases. They are coextensive, is the fancy word for this. They're coextensive, which means to say that they're conceptually different, but practically the same. We actually have another example of this in the Torah. I wonder if anybody can guess. Of two Isurim that have, they're two different verbs, but there is no case in the Torah that violates only one, but not the other. Anybody know? I mean to say that there's two actions that a person is not allowed to do, but you can't do one without doing the other.
So it got to do with the kashrut of fish?
I don't think so.
You can't have scales and fins, but you...
Well, fish have to have scales and fins.
You'll never find a kosher fish that doesn't have... Yeah. You can't have a fish with scales that doesn't also have fins.
Well, no, a kosher fish has to have scales and fins. And there are fish that have only fins but no scales. An eel, for example, I think, has fins but no scales.
It doesn't work the other way around.
Maybe, but that's not what I'm talking about. Two separate Isurim in the Torah. They're recorded in, for example, in the book of the mitzvot of the Rambam, two separate mitzvot, two averot actually, except you can't do one without doing the other. So you're always going to violate both. So I'll give you a hint. It has to do with Pesach. So there's a phrase that we say with two verbs, two Isurim, except we always say them together because you can't do one without doing the other. Anybody know what it is?
Yeah. And not to eat chomet and to eat matzah.
No, because you can certainly, I get what you're saying, but no, the example is Bal Yira'eh and Bal Yimatzeh. You shall not find and you shall not see chametz in your possession. So the Gemara goes through a bunch of cases and it says, basically, it throws up its hand and says, you can't have one without the other. Anytime you violate Bal Yira'eh, you violate Bal Yimatzeh. Anytime you violate Bal Yimatzeh, you always violate Bal Yira'eh. They're coextensive. And it's engineered like that. Basically, as this Gemara says, the idea is to make the prohibition more severe so that you can't violate one without violating the other. Now, when I say that they are still conceptually different, so for example, Rav Shimshon Fal Hirsch says that linguistically they're different. He says, Neshech, okay, phonetically relates to Nezek. Neshech sounds a little bit like Nezek. Designates interest on loans from the point of view of the damage, the loss incurred by the borrower. Okay? So Neshech refers to the Nezek caused to the borrower, to the Loveh. While Tarbit looks on it from the point of view of the increase, the gain to the lender, the Malveh. Now the fact is that the mitzvah of interest of neshech and tarbit, of ribit, applies to both the lender and the borrower. When ribit occurs, both of them are in violation. You would think that only the lender would be in violation, but it's not the case. The borrower is also in violation when he does it. In fact, in some cases, somebody who signs on a contract for who's not even involved could also potentially be in violation of neshech. So according to Rav Hirsch, though, the word neshech is related to the word nezek, and neshech simply looks at it from the point of view of the borrower, and tarbit looks at it from the point of view of the lender. Is there any other connection or metaphor that neshech brings to mind for anybody?
Neshech means biting.
Okay, so what could that possibly mean?
The lender is biting the borrower as he takes interest.
Good. So the Yalkut Shimoni writes, Meitim Shechye Yecheskel Shishim Ribo. Okay, Yecheskel brought the dry bones to life. V'kulam amdu al ragleim chutz me'ish echad. And all of them stood up except for one man. Okay, so you imagine all these bones standing, except one of them is not able to stand. One skeleton is not able to stand. Imagine. Amalei Anavi, Ribono Olamim, Mativo Shel Zayish. What happened to this guy? Amalei Ben Neshech Natan, V'tarbit Lakach, V'chay Chayalo Yechia. He said, even though I'm bringing him back to physical life, or I'm bringing the rest of them back to life, this one I can't bring back to life because he was involved in Neshech. He prevented life. So what does this mean? So here, in a different midrash, Amar Kadosh Baruch Hu, V'chay lo yechia neshech v'tarbit lakach, Amar Kadosh Baruch Hu, mi shechaya beribit b'olam hazeh, lo yechia b'olam haba. Lama? Haribit dome, lama haribit dome, l'mi sheneshecho nachash, v'lo yergish min neshecho, v'lo yada ad shenitbatet alav. Kach haribit ein adam argish bo ad shetitbatet alav. Okay? So neshech is like a bite, but it's like a bite of a snake. What happens when a snake bites you? You feel a little bit of a pinch, but you don't know anything. If it's a venomous snake, though, you're going to feel it later. You're going to be killed by the poison. So that's the way that neshech is as well. It's that way for the borrower, for sure, because, you know, he borrows a little bit of money. He thinks everything is fine. But slowly but surely, the person that he borrowed from bleeds him dry, right? Metaphorically speaking. It's also neshech for the lender, because the lender, you know, gets drip, drip, drip money. He doesn't think that he's doing anything wrong. Why? Because it doesn't feel like stealing. He thinks he's entitled to it. It's only a little bit each time, but slowly but surely it accumulates and it takes away his olam haba. So in that way, it's a bite both for the borrower and for the lender.
Interesting, Rav, because according to yesterday or the day before in Daf Yomi, it spoke about the snake bite, because it's comparing it to the snake that gets absolutely no benefit from biting its victim.
Yeah, yeah. So this comparison
is different. It's saying you get bite, but the snake is getting benefit in the form of ribbit or nesha.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because here. We're not really focused actually on the snake. We're focused on the bite. But yes, Mike, I believe the Gemara was talking about Lashon Hara, right? Lashon Hara is the comparison made to the snake.
Yeah.
Just like when a person speaks Lashon Hara, he doesn't get any benefit, but he does it anyway. So too, a snake doesn't get any benefit, but he does it anyways. Yeah. But here we're not focused on the snake. Here we're focused on the bite. So that's in terms of the Neshech over there. Now here's one of my favorite Kliyakars. It's my favorite because it's going to get everybody's hackles up. I want to know what you all think about this Kliyakar. Okay? The Kliyakar wants to know, what is the big problem with Ribit and why is it okay for us to do it with non-Jews? So he says, now you have to know before we even start this Kliyakar, what do you have to know about the Kliyakar? This is something that I say every time I quote the Kliyakar, something that you have to know when you read his commentary. Anybody know one of the things that he hated the most? What did he hate? The Kliyakar.
I think he hated literal interpretations.
He might have, but there's something that he hated in life more than anything. And dedicated, I'd say, I don't know, probably like 20% of his commentary to talking about.
Money?
He hated money. Everywhere you go in his commentary, he has bad things to say about money and what it does to people. He's the only one I know who says that when Yaakov went back for the Pachim Ketanim and he got in a fight with the angel, the reason he got in a fight with the angel was because he went back for the money. He shouldn't have gone back for the money. That's what the Kli Yakar says over there. So over here, what does he say? Ikar tam isur haribit hu lefi shehu meisir midat habitachon. Says, the real problem with ribit is not what you're doing to the person who's paying the ribit. It's actually what's happening to the person who is getting the ribit. Meisir midat bitachon min ha'adam. It takes away the bitachon of the person. Why? Ki kol bal masa umatan einav nisuot al Hashem lefi shehu mesupakim yarvich lo. Normally, a businessman, an entrepreneur, a startup person, he doesn't know what's going to happen with his company. So he's always praying to Hashem, Hashem, please make sure everything's okay. A farmer looks up at the skies to make sure. He prays so that there'll be rain. However, aval anotin beribit, revach shelo yadua v'katzuv. Somebody who lends on interest, his cash flow is stable and reliable. V'somech al irvuno shebiado min Hashem yasir libo. And therefore, he stops praying to Hashem. He says, I don't need you, Hashem. I know where my money is going to come from.
This is a pre-Madoff opinion.
It's a what?
Pre-Madoff, you know, you put the money with somebody.
Yeah, yeah. Well, like, yeah. Thank you, David, for pointing that out. It gets even worse. Ready for this? So, by the way, he says, as I pointed out, the problem here is not in the loveh. It's not that you're doing anything wrong to the loveh. That wouldn't be a problem. The problem is what's happening to the malveh. And the loveh's sin is that he is complicit in this act of bad faith on the part of the malveh. He's complicit in the fact that the malveh is no longer going to pray to Hashem. Hu machtia ta malveh. They become crude people because they're not involved in bitachon. Why is it mutter to give to non-Jews? Alam v'gazlan. Afilim u'kavush tachat yadcha. Mikol makom darkol avo ba'akifin. Va'afilim ervano biyado le'olam eino batuach lo b'keren v'lo b'rivach v'revach v'alken tamid einav nesuot al Hashem ha'tzilo miyado v'zeh tam isur haribit mikol makom. Why is it mutar to give interest, to lend on interest to a non-Jew? Because you can't trust them. Because you can't trust them. Because even if you lend them money and say, here, I want this and I want 20% back, and he says yes, you're never really sure if you're going to get the money back. And interestingly, the Kli Yakar, he could have just said, look, because you know they're always in charge and you can't really get the money from them because they're stronger. He says, no, even if they're not stronger, they're tricky and they're sneaky and they're shrewd and they're a bunch of Shylocks, right? That's what he seems to be saying. He seems to be saying that they're basically you can't trust a non-Jew to pay you money, to be honest in business. And because of that, there's no lack of bitachon when you lend him the money. Whereas if you lend a Jew money, there you're going to have a problem. What do you guys think of that?
Well, you can't read it in a 2021 context. You have to read it in the context of the Kli Yakar.
So I, for the most part, I agree. For the most part, I agree. I think I'll take his word for it that, until the 17th century, when he was writing this, this was pretty obvious to everybody that this felt right. Nowadays, in a Madoff economy, given the general stereotypes about Jews and non-Jews, I'm not sure that this is going to fly. However, I will make the following point. Mark Twain, Sam Clemens, wrote an essay called Concerning the Jews. It's actually a very long essay. People only know the last page. They only know the last three paragraphs. It's very famous. But the thrust of the paper is actually to defend Jews from the charge of being dishonest in business. He basically says, you know, everybody hates the Jews, and the reason they hate the Jews is because they're so good at business. They're so good at everything that they do. That's what he says. And there's a lot of amazing things in that article. Everybody should read it. But one of the points that he makes is, and if you want to say that Jews are dishonest in business, he says that makes no sense, because anybody who's really dishonest in business is bad at business. Because once they become dishonest and everybody knows they're dishonest, nobody wants to do business with them. One of the basic fundamental, you know, features of business is that you have to be trustworthy. And if nobody trusts you, then you're not going to get very far. So he says it must be that the Jews are trustworthy, because otherwise they, you know, nobody would do business with them. And we know people are doing business with them. Interesting, interesting argument. But yes, Michael, I agree.
The big issue with the key, what he said, is that it would imply that if you do have a ragingly successful business in today's day and age, you ask them to keep it.
I hear you. I mean, that's the implication over here. I don't think you'll find that would have to be a Kedoshim Tihi version of this. I don't see the Torah saying you have to give up
business.
Yeah.
You just did a thing with him.
I mean, there's a story about the Chavetz Chaim that supposedly, I assume the story is true, that he had a grocery store, and he told his wife that once they made enough money during the course of the day to sustain themselves for another day, he told her to close the store, so that other grocery stores could, imagine if the Chavetz Chaim has a grocery store, probably everybody's going to go to that store. So he didn't want to ruin the businesses of everybody else. So he said, once we make enough money for the day, we're going to close it, and that's it. So it's, you know, it's somewhat related over there, I guess, in a certain way. But I hear you saying, Mike. Rav Hirsch, we're going to actually see two Rav Hirsches here. This kind of dovetails with the Kliyakar. Rav Hirsch says, the law takes away the worst effect of the power of money, the most potent factor in causing social inequality. Rav Hirsch is interested in social inequality. It breaks the great power of capital. If this prohibition is strictly kept, all capital is in itself dead and unproductive and can only be used by wedding it to labor. And you know, you can hear the tinges of the 19th century in Rav Hirsch over here. It raises labor to the primary and essential factor of social well-being. Capital is forced to recognize the equality of labor. The rich man must either bring his otherwise dead capital to production by his own powers of work, or he must associate himself with the powers of labor of the poor man, share profit and loss with him, and in his own interests, further the interests of labor. I wonder what Rav Hirsch would think about Bitcoin. Right? Basically, Rav Hirsch does not believe in investment banking or in investments at all, pretty much. Well, I wouldn't say at all. But basically, he says, if you have money, you should be investing it in real business, in creating things, in making things. Money is not for making more money. That's what Rav Hirsch is saying. Rav Hirsch would be very against the whole, you know, basically the whole 21st century economy. You know, taking money and using it simply to make more money. He says money is there for increasing and progressing the world and creating and supporting labor. Okay? And so lending on interest is an illicit use of money, because that's not what it's for. Okay. Last point that I want to make tonight is another thing from Rav Hirsch. Where he himself addresses the question of why there's a difference between Jews and non-Jews. And I think it's a beautiful piece. He says, the Torah in no wise looks on interest on loans as anything which is morally wrong. It's not morally wrong. There's nothing morally wrong about taking interest. Okay? So that covers us for non-Jews. What about Jews? Otherwise, it would not forbid with equal solemnity the paying of interest as it does the taking of it, nor would it restrict the prohibition to Jews only. Were we the real owners of our money? And if the loaning of it was completely an act of our own free will, then possibly the interest on loans, which we would take after a time, might be considered neither as neshech nor tarbit. Our debtors may have earned money with our money, and it is just such a loan or business purposes that our text speaks. Right? In other words, I give somebody money, and he makes money. I lend him the money, and he makes money off of it. Why shouldn't I get a kickback? I gave somebody money. He opened up a business. He makes a lot of money on the business. And then he just gives me back the same amount of money? That doesn't seem fair. I have a portion in his business. The interest which he gives us is no loss of any of his fortune. It is only a part of the fruit which our capital has begotten in his hands. And if he makes money, he's not losing anything when he gives me back interest. He gained and I gained. It's a win-win. For we were not bound to lend him our money. Had we kept it in our own hands, it would also have been fruitful capital. And let's talk about that as well. If I kept the money, I could have invested it in my own business. But by giving it to somebody else, I lose that opportunity. And there's an opportunity cost there. I don't make money off of my own money. We could also have earned with it, and the interest we receive is of no real increase of our fortune. It is only compensation for an increase which we have lost. So here, Rav Hirsch has laid down the basic fundamental thing. There is nothing immoral about interest. You're not a bad person by charging interest. Yeah, Joe.
I'm not sure I understand why, because the underlying assumption is that the guy he's come to loan money. He's not going into business with you. He's loaning money because he doesn't have anything to eat, right? What the Torah says. The Torah says, "Ki amuch achicha imach." That's how we started off.
Yeah.
So
that's
That's
true. But then how do you explain lending money to somebody who's rich or somebody who doesn't need it or somebody who's trying to start a business? Over there as well, it's usher to take ribit. So in all cases, it's usher to take ribit. Let's just put it this way. If I lend money even to a poor person and he manages to get me my money back like he's supposed to, right? There's a good chance that whatever he did with my money, he probably made something, right? He probably could afford to give me at least a little bit of interest on that. I know that that's not always going to be the case. But in many cases, if a person borrows money from me, the chances are he can afford to give me interest. And it shouldn't be considered stealing. But I hear you. I hear you in the plain meaning of the verses. It's a poor person borrowing money from me, and I should just give it to him. But if he says there's nothing immoral.
You know what? You gave someone tzedakah and he turns up, you know, makes a lot of money from your tzedakah. Why wouldn't he need to give it back to you? You gave it to tzedakah because he needs it. Now he doesn't need it. Because it's tzedakah, that's the mitzvah,
him,
right?
Yeah,
the mitzvah loan, if you have a mitzvah to loan to a Jew, right?
You do.
So what, you're going to make money off that mitzvah?
In fact, if you can choose between loaning him and giving it to him, what are you supposed to do?
I think to loan. I'm not sure. I think to loan.
You're supposed to loan him the money, and then and then you're supposed to forgive the loan. But you loan him the money because you want to retain his dignity. That's the idea. Now, I hear you all, but the point, I think Rav Hirsch's point is that it applies in all cases, including cases where it might make sense to charge interest.
Rav Hirsch alludes to a point we haven't touched on yet, and maybe I'm jumping the gun here. But you might say that if I don't charge interest, I won't be willing to lend you money. And that means you won't be able to eat or you won't be able to start a business. And the fact
that the rabbis found a solution for that, didn't they? The rabbis found a solution for that. Heter Iska. That's the Heter Iska, which every single bank in Israel uses. And that's a way to lend money and still be able to kind of charge interest by turning the loan into an investment. That's how it works. And, you know, when people roll their eyes, it's like mechiras chametz, but it's the fact is that, legal fiction is legal. But we're not interested in that right now, because right now we're interested in the values that the Torah is trying to perpetuate. And so here the value is apparently you should not lend on interest. So if Hirsch's, the thrust here is that there's nothing morally wrong with charging interest. So why does, and the Haraya, we can do it with non-Jews. So why does the Torah not allow us to do it with Jews? So here's the argument. But now looking at it from the Jewish point of view, our money is not absolutely our own property. It is only conditionally ours. God has the real right of disposal of it. And he has made it our duty, as Yoel was mentioning, to place some of his property that happens to be in our hands into the hand of our brother. Right? Not only to provide the necessities for his life, but also for the upkeep and continuation of his business. So it's not only for poor people. Against his duty to pay us back a similar sum in certain time, the money, which up till then had been ours at God's behest at the moment of transition, becomes his. That's his with a lowercase h, not God's, but the man who you're lending it to. It is not with our money. It is with his own that he does business. This is a huge idea, right? Rav Hirsch here is flipping things over. He's saying, when I lend money to a Jew, based on the mitzvah of lending money to a Jew, it's not my money anymore. And it's not my money that I'm lending. It has been transformed into that person's money. And that is why the profit made is the profit of his activity with his own money and consequently exclusively his. If we demand any part of it, we are demanding a neshach of his fortune, and at the same time, in any case, tarbit, in addition to our fortune, not compensation for anything that we might have been able to earn with our money loaned. We could not have loaned that, used that money because we had no right to keep it, as God, the real owner of our property, had placed at the disposal of somebody else. This is a paradigm shift, right? Rav Hirsch is saying, and you could say the same thing for tzedakah, that the moment the mitzvah of lending money kicks in, that money is actually not ours. Like, in the same sense that if I spent money on an etrog, that money that I spent is, you know, it's not mine. I can't ask for it, you know, back or anything because it's not mine anymore. I was using it to perform a mitzvah. So too, when I give the money to somebody else and lend him the money, that wasn't a simple financial transaction. Like, oh, here, you can borrow some of my money and then you'll pay it back because you owe it to me. No, no, no. I lent him the money. He has a mitzvah to pay me back. I have a mitzvah to give him. He has a mitzvah to pay me back. The profit on that money doesn't belong to me, not conceptually and not actually. That's how Rav Hirsch reads this. But, of course, this only applies when I lend money to a Jew. Why? Because there's only a mitzvah to lend money to a Jew. There is no mitzvah to lend money to a non-Jew. I don't remember if Rav Hirsch deals with it, but I think the reason that he gives is because there's no mitzvah for a non-Jew to lend money to us. So there's not going to be a mitzvah for us to lend money to him. But one way or another, there's no mitzvah to lend money to a non-Jew. So there's no problem with charging ribit because that's a financial transaction when I lend the money to a non-Jew. And in a financial transaction, it's true. That's my money that he has and the profit that he makes on it belongs to me. What do you guys think?
What's bothering me here is that if when I lend somebody money, it's really his money that I'm lending him. And now that it's his, what is his obligation to give anything back to me? It's his money.
The Torah says he has to give you money back. That's my point. That's Rav Hirsch's point.
But it's his money.
Disconnect. No, but
it's his money.
Okay, but he has a separate, almost like he has a separate obligation to give you money back now. You have an obligation to give him money, and then once you give it to him, he has an obligation to give you money. It's not your money that he's giving back, though. That's the beauty. It's not your money that he's giving back. It's separate money.
I've heard said that people who have more money feel that that extra money was just placed in their hands until the person who really needs it and it belongs to asks for it in some way, shape, or form. And then
that's the must
they give it back to this other guy who really is holding it for safekeeping in some way. Maybe to give it back to him again, or maybe to give it to another person who needs it.
Yeah, maybe. Rav Dessler sees tzedakah that way. I'm sure everybody has heard this idea before, and Siva Shalom has it as well, that tzedakah, when you give tzedakah, it's not your money that you're giving, it's the person's money, because you have an obligation. Hashem put it in your possession so that you would be the shaliach to transfer it to the ani. So this is a form of that. And by the way, these words just reminded me that this is its connection to Shemitah and Yovel. The connection here to Shemitah and Yovel is that just like Hashem has control and is the owner, the Baalim of Eretz Yisrael, which is why Shemitah and Yovel work the way they do in terms of not working the land and returning the land to its ancestral ownership, physical money is the same way. And even actually not even physical money, also property as well is the same way. All property is this way. All property belongs to Hashem. And when he says, lend it to somebody, you lend it to them, and then they give you money back, but it's not the same money. That appears to be the theory of Hirsch in terms of ribbit.
That same concept, though, wouldn't it be that Hashem has the right of redisposing, if I can use the word, redistributing the money that person's got? In the same way, it's not his. It becomes Hashem's to redistribute, and Hashem has said he should give it back to you.
The socialist undertones over here are inescapable, which they are in general in Yovel and Shemitah as well. I mean, I gave a share on that once in the past also, on the socialist overtones of all these halachot, our own form of it. Not necessarily pure socialism, but there's something to it. So what we covered tonight is we asked three questions. Number one, why do we have two words for the same thing, Neshech and Tarbit? And the Gemara struggles to figure out whether they're two separate things. And they, in fact, are two separate things. They just are coextensive. They are always covering the same acts. The Mefarshim point out that Neshech and Tarbit could be referring, Neshech could be referring to the borrower, Tarbit could be referring to the lender. The second question that we asked, which is why is it coming after Shemitah and Yovel? That could be either a moral thing in terms of, Shemitah and Yovel is about taking care of the little guy. So over here as well, it's about taking care of the little guy. Or as Rav Hirsch says, it could be that the ultimate message is everything belongs to Hashem. And then finally, we asked the question, which I think is the major question, why is it okay to charge interest to non-Jews if it's not okay to do it to Jews? And we gave at least two separate answers to that. One is the Kli Yakar, which is a emunah aspect. The Kli Yakar kind of also a paradigm shift. We tend to think that the problem of ribit is that you're lending the money on ribit. But the problem is really that you're getting the money back, the ribit back. And the problem there is that it's going to cause a pagam in your emunah. You're not going to trust Hashem because you're just going to trust yourself. You're going to know that you're going to get the money back. And Rav Hirsch, in two different comments, one comment says that the problem is that money should not be used to make more money. That's number one. And separately, he says that the reason why we're allowed to lend to non-Jews is because there's nothing wrong with lending to non-Jews on interest. There's nothing wrong with it. There's nothing wrong with the whole act. It's fine. The only problem is when you lend money to a Jew, you're doing it as a mitzvah. And so when you lend him the money, you have no chelik in that money anymore. It's not yours, it's his. You have an obligation to give him that money. And so when he actually earns profit on that, that profit doesn't accrue to you, it accrues to him, it's his money. He simply has an obligation to return the keren, what's the keren in English?
The principal.
The principal, thank you. The principal, he has obligation to return the principal without anything else, because that was his core obligation. That's what you gave him. That's what he gives back. All right. Shakach. I want to wish everybody a Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you.